You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
I invite you to join me as we explore new ideas. I'm David Bryan. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Curiosity Invited. I hope it's back to Curiosity Invited. And if not, welcome for the first time. And today I am actually really looking forward to this conversation, which grows out of a book. And my guest today is a gentleman named Tim Disney. Yes, that's the last name that everybody's familiar with. Maybe we'll talk about it at the end, but who knows? Because what we're here to talk about is a book that Tim, welcome. My apologies for not saying that. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. Welcome, and thank you for giving up some time and talking about this absolutely fabulous, fun read. It is a graphic novel called The Ark. And I know you had some compatriots in this project. Say something about all that.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
So the book, The Ark, was an inspiration for me during the pandemic, basically. We were all stuck at home, which I will say I wasn't that upset about because I don't mind just staying home. So that was okay for me. But the whole experience was obviously traumatic for everybody. And as I was looking around the world and watching not just the effects of the pandemic on my family and my city and the world, but the political reaction to that and the public commentary around it, you know, it was just a terrible, terrible experience. Things have gotten worse since then. That seemed unlikely at the time, but at the time felt pretty catastrophic. And, you know, just the idea of a pandemic of lying, which is basically what if we had a pandemic that really did wipe out the earth, but it was the cause of it was dishonesty, lying, misinformation, disinformation, etc. And that struck me as a very powerful premise. And I actually pitched it to a friend of mine as a movie idea. And he said, great idea. Why don't you do it as a graphic novel? For two reasons. One, nobody's making any movies right now. And secondly, it should be faster and cheaper and easier to do. Turns out it was not faster or easier, certainly cheaper than making a movie. But the idea had not occurred to me before that and struck me as an interesting thing to do. Now, I have some background in animation. One of my first jobs, entertainment-related jobs, I worked at Disney in the animation department. So I had some exposure to that. And with every movie project, you do a certain amount of storyboarding. Mm-hmm. The whole job in animation is essentially storyboarding, is composing a story visually. So that idea was familiar to me. And I thought of it as kind of like storyboarding a movie. It isn't exactly that, but there's a relationship there. So my friend Sanjay, who I had pitched the movie to, had done a graphic novel project, and he introduced me to the author of that, J.C. Lasik. So I connected with J.C., and he brought in the artist. And so J.C. is I call him James, J.C. J.C. is his authorial name, is the co-writer and also the creative director of the project. So he's a kind of the producer of it. He's the one who managed recruiting the artist, Vincent, and then formatting the book and doing the physical process of producing it. So I'm the creator of the book, because the basic idea was mine, and the co-writer of it. So we worked on it as kind of a side project, just here and there while I was doing lots of other things. So it was not a full-time undertaking, and it took us a few years to pull it all together.
And this was all during the pandemic, or at least it took part, it started.
And since, yeah. And the book will be published in this summer. It will be launched at Comic-Con in July. It's published by a fantastic company called Gungnir Books. And I'm super grateful. They're wonderful people. They love the idea, and they're behind it. And, you know, so we finished it, I think, the fall of last year. Finished it because once we finished it enough to go around and start selling it to people, we printed some copies of it because it's a hard thing to comprehend as a PDF, you know, and I didn't want to send PDFs around anyway. So we printed a few copies because a graphic novel needs to be read as a book, you know, more than a conventional book, I think. I read books on my iPad. People read on their Kindles. I think that's pretty good. I like reading a real book. It's better, but it's so convenient on my iPad. You kind of can't really do that with a graphic novel. And it's one of the mainstays of the retail book industry are graphic novels. It's the category that's holding up.
Really?
It's very important.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Folks are very dedicated to that format.
Well, it's good that you mentioned that because, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
no, go ahead, finish.
Not our publication date. We realized the world is changing so rapidly, and our book is a topical political satire. So we had to squeeze into it as many current references as we possibly could. So we dove back into it and added a bunch of new material, changed a bunch of material, and packed it as full as we could with current references. Now, there was a cutoff point and we're past it now. And now other stuff has happened. And I'm like, I wish I could get that in there, but there's a limit.
Well, that may be the only argument. I read it as a PDF and I definitely, and I loved it, although I did not like the experience. Who wants to stare at a screen more than I have to anyway? But, and I did, I wanted to hold this thing in my hand and, but maybe that's the argument for a PDF, is that you get to keep playing if you want to. You do. And there sure is a lot more material. So,
yeah. Well, when we got the first copies, now I have not seen what will be the final copy yet. That will come, I think, in June or early July when it comes back from the printer. But when we got the first galleys, to just hold the physical thing in my hand, what a joy that was. Because I'm a long, avid reader, and I love books, and I never thought that I would write one. It seemed like
this is the first. This is the first book. You've done movies, right? You've done movies.
I've written screenplays and things like that. Yeah. But a book, that
this
always seemed like people smarter than me write books. I could never do that. And it turns out it's not about smartness. It's just about persistence, you know, and hanging in there. It's about scale. Books are long.
Yeah. Yeah. But I will say to anybody who's wondering, pondering, geez, do I want to look at that? Well, first of all, it's not out just yet, but it's a great experience. It really is. I found it so super creative. And unlike, I've tried graphic novels numerous times, and unlike at least the ones that I've tried, the panels followed one another. I mean, it was really, you know, for those of us who read books and go, or watch movies. It's a pleasure. It was a pleasure. So I'm a fan. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So it's a virus that, or it's a something that, that is lethal to everyone who's got it, who lies. It is only effective when somebody is untrue.
Yes. So I guess the elevator pitch would be that the world's elites have gathered at a Davos-like conference called the Global Reinvestment for Tomorrow Conference, the GRIFT Conference. And the global elites are there, the grifters, and they're there to solve climate change once and for all. And so we see a panoply of real life personalities there, celebrities, politicians, tech bros, et cetera.
No one is safe. A lot of people everybody would recognize are at the grifters.
Yes, of all stripes, because certainly there's a mendacity on all sides. And while they're at the grift conference, they're infected with this virus that shows no symptoms, is undetectable until you lie. And then it just kills you. And there's no gray area for, honey, do I look fat in this? That's you say, no, you look at that, you're gone.
Right.
So as you can imagine, this wreaks havoc on the world. So the grifters get on their private jets and they spread it throughout the world and it just wreaks utter mayhem. So most of the action of the story takes place on a cruise ship because, I don't know,
a cruise ship is not populated by the grifters, right? This is a different group.
It's a crazy cast of ordinary people. And so we see the story play out on the cruise ship against the backdrop of global events. And some of the folks on the cruise ship figure out what's causing it. And a bunch of stuff happens, and you'll have to read the book to see what all that is. But essentially, they land and discover a handful of other people who have also figured it out. And we get a little glimpse of what a life on Earth, a post-lie world might look at. So the ark metaphor is obviously, you know, a biblical metaphor. In our story, ARC is an acronym for Amazonian recombinant cytoneuropathy. That's just a technobabble term for the disease
that causes this.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's an arc.
Yes.
So, it is a new beginning.
Completely, completely. So something that my co-writer mentioned to me, maybe just as we were really getting going into it, is that he kind of casually said, you know, graphic novel readers, they really love all the supplementary material. They like little glimpses of, you know, how the illustrative style came about, concept drawings, background information, that kind of thing. And that just clicked, something clicked for me when he mentioned that. And it just occurred to me that we could make this book different by going very hard on the footnotes and the footnotes to footnotes and introducing all kinds of supplementary characters and diving deep into material in facetious and also legitimate ways.
Yes, I was about to say.
Thanks. Right.
Yeah. It is not that second piece that you're just referring to. In some ways, it's the world that you're, it's a glimpse into the world you've created. And at the same time, it is a more detailed glimpse into the world and the world that we have created.
Yeah.
So do you think there's an epidemic of lying?
I absolutely do. And I think there always has been. I think it's worse than it's ever been. But it's always been the case, which is why we did a lot of historical stuff. Yeah.
It's worse than it's ever been. Do you think because of the places where it shows up, right? Do I look fat in this? Is a different sort of lie than, wait, did we drop that bomb on a school? Right? It feels like it. The consequences are, right? It's not troubling because it's so obviously a book. And at the same time, is it okay to say, no, you look great in that? Or is it, right? Are you preaching about honesty, or are you opening up a political discourse, a discourse about the state we're in?
There's a lot of philosophical and sociological literature about exactly this topic, and I looked into a lot of those things. I did a lot of reading around that, and you know, this is something that from the time of the Greeks and others, there's been a lot of discussion about this. And you know, I think it's one of these matters of cultural matters that there is not an absolute answer to. So I think that we, you know, if you want to go down a rabbit hole like this briefly, you know, that as people, we have an interior world, and there's our exterior personalities, the open realm in which we deal with each other and we have a conversation like we're having now. I know a little bit about you. I know a little bit about your background based on looking you up on the internet and the conversation that we had to prepare for this. You know a little bit about me. Those are the open things. We know those things about each other.
Right.
Then there are private things, and you have an interior life. You have your own thoughts. You have secrets. I do too. And then there's this third realm of blind spots. There are things that you probably observe about me that I don't know about myself, and likewise.
And vice versa.
About you. And, you know, and I think you can say that maybe there's a direct correlation between secrets and blind spots. To the extent that I harbor secrets, I also have blind spots, you know, which kind of is a scary idea. And then there's this other realm, the fourth realm, the biggest one, which is mystery or something like that. We don't know. Something that nobody knows. And so we've got to come to some kind of cultural, uncomfortable middle ground on all of these things. So yeah, it's compassionate to say, no, you look great. Right. But we play with fire when we give ourselves permission to do that. So I think we have to be conscious of what is healthy and what isn't healthy around that. And I think we've gotten to a bad place with that. We used to
Do you think it's widespread? Do you think that's why it's been that we have all gotten to a bad place with that?
No.
Or that there are certain. Okay.
Yeah.
There's lots of absurd.
There's lots of really virtuous, great, fantastic people out there. And of course, and who behave in that manner at risk to themselves. Right. So it takes courage to operate in the world in that way. I remember when I was first in business, you would run across people who would not so often, but occasionally would just straight up lie to you about something. And, because most people don't really do that, because they're afraid they're going to get caught or it feels wrong, whatever the reason, there's a disincentive to doing it. But then I remember catching somebody doing that who just kind of like, sent us this contract that was completely at odds with what we had agreed. And I'm like, what's up with this? And he said, it's business. It's just business. So that kind of a thing, that kind of permission structure, has run rampant. And I think that technology is playing into this. So we now have tools for lying at a scale that, and with some degree of anonymity or plausible deniability or something that has supercharged it. I mean, I don't think it's causing it, but it's supercharging it.
I think an element of it, I was chuckling a minute ago because of what you just said. Yeah, like you have worked in the film world, the entertainment world, the film world, and there's a joke, which I won't remember, but the punchline is this guy is, saying something about the deal that they're about to enter. And one guy is talking and the other guy says, "Wait, hey, you're lying." And he says, "Yeah, I know, but let me finish." Right. As if it's so common and expected. Right. But I think it's also the places where it appears that it's in the institutions that it appears that have frequently been where we all looked for facts, for truth, for at least a yearning for that, whether we could ever achieve it. And somehow that area, whether it's the business world, the tech bros, the politicians, the journalists that behave as if they are not in a special role. So, hey, everybody says you look great in that. So, they're lying, I'm lying, whatever. And the other side, it's always important to always be honest as the Gestapo comes knocking on the door and says, "You're not hiding anybody in your attic who might be Jewish, right?" "Oh, absolutely not." "Or no, I can't tell a lie. Yeah, Anne Frank is up there." I mean, the absurdity of to whom, what are the conditions, right? What's the result?
So it's messy. It's a puzzle. It's a messy business. And to try to live an open and honest life is aspirational. Nobody can fully achieve it. I certainly can't. I'm not claiming any personal virtue, but I do think we could probably generally agree that our current situation is pretty bad. It's no coincidence that the people, comedians, that use humor in these most dire of circumstances. I know that places like Russia and Israel and Palestine and other places have very strong, political, satirical humor traditions going contemporarily now, these days, because it's the only way that you can say some honest things.
Right.
About right. stuff. So, yeah. And we made a big effort to be as even-handed as we could about that. I suppose if you read the whole book, my personal sensibilities will come out in it, and that's okay.
Well, that makes sense, right? Yeah. You did
but
write it.
It's not a polemic, It's not a polemic.
No. And I think that's, I was thinking about that the choice to make it a graphic novel and and obviously, you know, obviously not the truth in some ways. I don't mean the truth in the sense that you're lying, but it's not a periodical. You don't feel like you're reading a New York Times article. And so that was, it's not a polemic. It doesn't hit you that way. And at the same time, it is a moral tale. And in a sort of obvious way that it's like, oh, what a good thing. Because boy, do we need that.
Well, I've always thought that the Old Testament, from which the Ark story comes, of course, you know, is very different than the New Testament. In the Old Testament, there's a lot of like anger and spite and, you know, the God of the Old Testament is a much more emotional human kind of comprehensible human thing. And he's like, what have you done here? Like I made you this whole world and this is what you've done. I'm wiping it all out.
I'm going to wipe it out.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Particular things, and maybe it's obvious, but why a cruise ship? Why is that the place where sense is being made?
Well, for two reasons. One, that at the beginning of the pandemic, there were a couple of cruise ship things that were very prominent in the pandemic story.
And I totally remember that. Yeah.
Cruise ships are sort of fundamentally comical, I think.
Total agreement.
Fantastic short piece by the late writer David Foster Wallace called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again.
I'll Never Do Again, right?
Yeah. And, that is just genius, that piece, because it's specifically about his cruise ship experience. The magazine sent him and he got the free cruise and he went on it and he wrote. But it's about much more than the cruise ship. So that came into my mind. And then I had read, I'm one of the few people who actually read the entire book, Infinite Jest, which relies heavily on footnotes. So it's super pompous to say I was inspired by David Foster Wallace because, you know, he's in another category altogether. But the way that he uses a topic to talk about a whole lot of things, and particularly the heavy use of footnotes and the experience of going into the footnotes and then going back and finding where you were, this discontinuity or something.
Yeah. It really changes the pace of reading, which in a thoughtful sort of way, at least when it's done really intentionally. Is there a reason it's a conference about the environment? Or did you just want to call out one of the largest obvious contradictions, except for the people who do it, flying to those conferences about the environment in their private jets?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, we the other plague we have is of inequality, wealth inequality, income inequality, et cetera, you know, has reached proportions that are, you know, obscene. And there's a great writer named Anand Giridharadas. I don't know if you know him. He wrote this book. You know, a lot of people write about this. Cory Doctorow, many, many other writers that I find a lot of inspiration in talk about this topic. But his book, Anand's book, is called Winners Take All. And it is about the premise is super simple, but he goes into he explores the topic quite deeply. But the premise is the language of giving back, you know, so there's the story that we tell is like, we've done well, and now we're going to give back. Okay, you know, I'll take that at face value as an earnest and sincere idea. But it's also, when you take one further step back, just absolutely absurd. So if you feel obliged to give something back, why did you take it in the first place? Like, why just not take it? You know, then there would be nothing to give back. So the language of that defeats itself. You know, it asks that question. So yeah, you know, and I had a lot of experiences in, you know, as you say, I've been in business. I ran a software company for some period of time. A long time ago, I've been a director of for-profit companies. I currently sit on a board of a pharmaceutical company, you know, a biotech company. That's a very interesting thing. I've done prefab housing companies, other things, been involved in not-for-profit things. Like, it was the chairman of an art college for a while. I sat on the board of a museum and an architecture school and other things. So I've had some exposure to those worlds, and I've talked to tax attorneys. I've talked to corporate transactional lawyers. You know, I get a little glimpse of a variety of different worlds. And, you know, you start to see systems and how those things kind of all connect together and work and don't work, and how some separation from the rest of the world happens, that there's an internal logic, which makes sense, but it's removed from everyone else. And so I was just trying to address that, you know?
Yeah, I see that. And I'm so curious about that. In some ways we have, well, in some ways we have no similar background, but that list of things that you've been involved in, mirrors a bunch of my life. I know I have found myself wearied by trying to have the conversation that you just made reference to, which was, you know, oh, how did you say it? If you feel the need to give it back, why'd you take it to begin with? Right? That the idea, I mean, I frequently raised it as, look, you know, having more will not change your life one iota. You can't spend fast enough for it to change your life. So why not stop? Why not keep doing what you're doing? By all means, go for it. You know, dive deeply into the things you do and you do well and give you joy and all that. But just don't take any more. And it's, you know, you point at systems. It's as if the system has captured the shaped, the language, the whole ideology, what can be thought within that system. And I think that system has infected the system of everybody else. It is not just people, right? It's not just the elites. The elites have had an effect, right? I mean, it is that virus has spread to everyone. And in some ways, that's one of the things about I love about the mechanism you put in your story is that everybody's got it. Now, what do we all do?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting that you use the word fair, because that idea, you know, that's a fair is a subjective term. It's a general agreement. What's right and what's not right. And that can change, you know, what we consider to be fair. So we could.
Absolutely.
We could decide that, you know, if you make in excess of $50 million a year, or whatever number you pick, $10 million a year, $5 million a year, whatever the number is, that those dollars above that amount are useless to you. You know, I think that's part of the point that you're making, because there is nothing else to buy, right? So I can imagine a world where someone in that situation agrees that, go ahead and tax away most of those dollars because I don't need them. It was very gratifying to work hard and be successful and earn them. And I feel proud of that. And I'm happy for them to then, you know, go back and to pay for schooling at college and storm drain systems and fire equipment and, you know, all the things that we need for a functioning society. We're not in that place right now.
No, we're not.
Because that's not fair. You know, another huge inspiration for me in this book is this great writer, a very well-known person who sadly died at a very young age, named David Graeber, who's written a bunch of incredible books, including Debt, The First 5,000 Years, incredible book. And then the last project that he wrote with another author before he died is called The Dawn of Everything. and it's another book that has deeply researched. It's anthropology, it's archaeology, it's sociology, it's a whole lot of things. But the premise is, to my mind, is very simple, which is that it doesn't have to be like this, that there are other ways of organizing things. And there are many examples of it, because we have this idea that we look at pyramids you know, the remains of castles, all these things that all of history appears to be dudes with armies and castles and power ruling a 90% of the population who are essentially
absolutely
serfs or laborers or something like that. And obviously that is true to at least a certain extent. And now you have this whole class of people who think that they've rediscovered this as a new idea. You have people like Peter Thiel and, you know, Curtis Yarvin, and there are many, you know, there's a whole thing, archaeofuturism or whatever they want to call that. We're like, we've got this amazing idea that there should be a thug who runs things and everybody else works for him. Like this is an amazing idea. This is the default structure. And most of the world operates in this way, and it's shitty. And when we operate like that, things are fucked up. It's a raw exercise of power. One dude who has control of everything inevitably makes terrible decisions. And
really,
in front of us, like and so, you know, the radical. So David Graeber, I suggest that you have these examples from all over the world, and then you have vast spaces in between those things. Like in Egyptian history, you've got the periods between the Old Kingdom and the Middle Kingdom, and between the Middle Kingdom and the new kingdom. These are like hundreds of years of time. So what happened in that time? People lived and farmed. They didn't need the fucking thing. So if you turn your mind the other way and just look in the other direction, you see vast examples. People arranging things in different ways. It doesn't have to be like this. We can do another arrangement. It's within our power to do it.
Yes.
You know, and that the Enlightenment idea that which he argues came from Native European exposure to Native American cultures, which I don't have an opinion about. I don't know enough about that. Yeah. Like right or not a right, but I'm intrigued by that idea.
Yes.
That we are each individuals with equal rights and dignity, and that, you know, we can create a government of our own design and hold it accountable to do what we charge it to do. You know, that is the radical idea, right? That's the red, that remains.
That is. And it absolutely is.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of that in the thing.
And I think, you know, one of the things that I love about the ending, assuming we're not paying attention to that whole other portion of the book that is not the story, is that the people are now in the position of having to puzzle out, and with the help of the virus in some ways, having to puzzle out, well, just how do we live in relationship with one another in an honest way? Right. So that we don't die. Right. So that is, and I think you're right, that like it seems impossible sometimes for people to see it, to figure it out, and yet, you know, I think even in this, even in very simple situations, people see the absurdity of what we've created, right? I mean, it's not fair. In my world, I would run into that as an educator. I would, when a student would need something, this student that, you know, has dysgraphia, can't take notes, whatever, furrows, this student needs something, and they get something. And inevitably, a bunch of people, usually parents, say, that's not fair that student gets that. And, you know, and I arrived on this metaphor that a different situation that they instantly understood, said, you know, depends what you mean by fair. Because, like, you know, God forbid right now you have a heart attack, you fall, drop to the ground, you choke on something, you drop to the ground. I know how to give mouth to mouth resuscitation. I can do that and I can save your life. But I can't do it for everybody else in this room. so I can't do it for you because that's not fair. It wouldn't be fair if I did that for you and not for everybody. And it's like, so fairness might mean people get what they need as opposed to everybody gets the same damn thing. And they get it in sort of, but
yeah,
but it's a big system that's captured our minds, our collective minds.
Truly, truly. And as we're having this conversation, I just want to point out for the listeners that despite this talk of philosophy and archaeology, the book is funny.
The book is quite funny. And that's one of the things that's so special about it, I think, is that it is all that, but it opens up. If you enjoy thinking about that, which I do, you obviously do, right? It opens up all sorts of conversations that are important conversations that we have, especially now. We don't need a virus. We've got the virus already. So,
well, maybe, yeah, we do. And maybe this is an opportunity for a moment of change, you know, because I think our country has been an extremely successful one. You can make the argument that, you know, if you look over the last, I don't know, 100 years, 75 years, or whatever time period you want to pick, we have been perhaps the most successful civilization or nation state ever. You know, we've amassed unimaginable wealth and power. As a hegemon, we have probably been relatively benign, not absolutely benign, lots of terrible things, but, you know, not on the scale of some other malicious overlord kingdoms we've seen throughout history. You know, and people will argue with me about that, and that's fine. That's
yes,
a contrary thing
sure
to say.
Right.
But, you know, so it is very hard for us to change. So we have systems, we think we've got it all lined up. And so, it, just like people we know in our own lives, how difficult is it to make change in our own individual lives? Usually we need a catastrophe to happen before you have a heart attack. And then you go like, oh my God, I got to change my diet. But usually it takes the heart attack to get people to change their ways. And so we might be having a heart attack right now, you know, and it's terrifying. And people will get hurt, but it also does present an opportunity to make some fundamental changes. So, you know, that's why it was very important for us to make the book a hopeful one, which, and I think that it is, you know, in the end, there's definitely a strain of hope that these folks could come together,
yes,
and imagine something different.
Right. And imagine and work to make it so. Okay. The book ends. It's 10 years later. What does it look like?
You know,
you got
I don't
any
know.
Ideas?
I've been thinking, if the book is successful, will there be a sequel or other follow-on material, and what should it portray? And part of me doesn't want to touch to that because
it doesn't want to touch it because there are other projects on the palette, or because
you know, there are all kinds of ideas that I have for stories related to the cast of characters and situations that we've portrayed, but specifically the future of this new world, I'm afraid of trying to portray that because I don't know that I can imagine what that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we might ruin it by getting specific about it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's so mind-opening. I love it. I really love it. And can we shift a bit? Just because you raised it at the beginning, and you have a name, Disney, and it's related to that, to the name that we all know as Disney. Well, two things about that. One is, I don't know your other work. I'm not immersed in it. I love this. I think a lot of people associate the name Disney with telling stories, but they're stories that are frequently sugary, and there are no terrible things going on in Disney. Well, there probably are, but sure. Somebody tries to steal Dumbo, put him in a, I mean, terrible, unbelievable.
Well, apparently you haven't seen Bambi. So,
and Bambi, oh my God. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how'd you grow up to be who you are in the Disney world?
I am related to the Disney family. Walt Disney was my grandfather's brother, my great uncle. So my grandfather's name is Roy. He was Walt's partner in the business. They, they were literally covered wagon people. You know, they were Midwesterners, laborers, farmers, and Walt was an extraordinary talent, obviously. And together they came to Los Angeles in the 1920s and they built this business. You know, that was a time where lots of things were opening up. My grandfather was the business side of the partnership, and he was a well-loved and respected person. At the same time, you know, as I became an adult, I learned about other aspects of what they did, that they fought the unions, they did, you know, they were people, you know, with mixed traits. Right. And my dad grew up around it and worked at the company all throughout his young adult lives and into middle age. He made TV shows for the Sunday night TV shows. He made about 35 of those shows over the years, Sunday night shows. So you and I are of a certain age. I remember watching those. Like, we would gather around the TV, you know, the big giant TV console thing, literally like Mad Men.
With the small screen. Sort
of, yeah, exactly. And we watched those, and my dad made a bunch of those, and that was a really fascinating thing to grow up around because they were pretty small scale productions by today's standards.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, they were like a boy and his dog stories primarily, and some of them were quite good. And he would often go off on location to do them. He did something in the Yucatan. He did something in Tahiti. He did something in Bahrain. He worked all over the place. And so we got to travel with him when he did those things. That was fascinating.
And were you of the vintage where you dove into that world as well or no?
No, I mean, when he was doing those shows, I was really quite young. So I didn't have much of a thought about it. It's just what my dad did. It didn't seem extraordinary to me, you know? It was just normal. So we used to go to Disneyland on occasion, which we were always excited about. When I see we, it's me and my siblings, and we were four kids in 4 years. We were like a tight little knot of kids.
Right.
And we always had to get dressed up and behave well when we went to Disneyland. It was something we looked forward to, but also we were afraid of getting in trouble. So we were on a short leash because we had to represent, you know, but you get to go backstage and, you know, see the workings of it and stuff like that. It was a really fascinating thing. And then the company had hard times after the death of first Walt and then my grandfather. There was a succession problem, and maybe, I don't know, it was all over the news in the 70s and 80s. There was a lot.
I remember that. I remember sort of tangentially. Yeah.
Yeah. And then my dad left the company for some period of time, and then he was able to pull together a new management team and engineer a change of management there. And that led to a renaissance at the company. So when we think of the new golden age of animation, Lion King, The Maid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, and all these movies that came as a result of this change. So I had just graduated from college, and he asked me, do you want to come in, try this out? And I, without thinking about it much, agreed to do that. I had never had the ambition of getting into the movie business. I studied Greek sculpture in college. I was a fine arts major, and I had a job offer at the Getty, and I thought about doing that, but I went and I did this instead. And it was interesting, and I worked there for about 4 years. I co-wrote the screenplay for a movie called Oliver and Company, which was an animated movie of the time. It was a big hit for them at that time. It was eclipsed by the things that came after that, but it was the beginning of their renaissance era. And that was an amazing experience for me. And I'm so grateful that I had that experience. And I got to work with people who had been there since the 90s and had worked with Walt and had some exposure to that. Really incredible. And I would describe it as a culture of quality in that good was not good enough. They were constantly working things to be the best they could be, just relentlessly trying to make something better and better and better and better and better. And that's not common, you know?
Right. That is not common.
And so that was a
and no story. Longer. I mean, are there any Disneys involved with Disney these days?
I don't think so. So that was the beginning of where when I was a little kid, people would hear my name and they would say, oh, that's so wonderful. Jungle Book was my favorite movie. Or they would have some personal memory. I mean, it brought to mind a personal experience. That was normally the, and then after that, people would say, oh, you must be super rich, right? Like their association with it changed to just giganticness.
Right.
And so the company has become a colossus. I think that they do a lot of great stuff. I don't have any big criticisms of the Disney company. I wish for them that they would be different, but I don't think it's reasonable to expect them to be. And so they're a company, they have shareholders, they have very broad share ownership. They're not dominated by family ownership or any individual. It's a very widely held company. And I don't think, you know, I don't think they're terrible malefactors, nor do I think they set any kind of exceptional shining example of corporate behavior. Corporations are not going to save us. They're going to do what they need to do to survive and make money. The business of business is making money. That is the prime directive. That's the prime directive. And we should not fool ourselves that they're going to be moral or anything. Right.
That's the conversation you were pointing at before, though. And there is the, I detect, and I could be wrong, but there's a yearning for, it doesn't have to be that way.
You know, unless we change the rules and define things differently, I don't know why it would be different than it is. You know, so I think Disney trades on an idea or a cultural idea or position. And so a large part of its value is the idea that people have about it. And I would suggest that that gives them an opportunity, maybe an obligation, to set a somewhat different example, but that's in the realm of, you know, that's just words I'm saying. That is that's not a thing in the marketplace.
Well, and the only reason anybody would think those words mean more than they do, not as important as they are, because I think they're important, but that the only reason people would think those words mean more than they do, it happens to be your last name.
Well, and I think so that somebody does not entitle me to anything other than a cranky opinion. I mean, I get to have is a cranky opinion. So that's what I have.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And, and like I said, I've great respect for the amazing success that they've had and the many fantastic products that they've put out there and stories. And I think on the whole, if you look at their, especially the animation stuff and the Pixar movies and all of those, these are very positive, pro-social, good things that they put into the world. Like, look at the movie Coco. Like, Coco as an example. You know, it's about, it was created by a group of people who have, you know, that cultural experience. And it's about the Day of the Dead in Mexico, and it became the biggest selling movie in China. Like, you're doing something powerful if you can reach audiences like that with a positive story like that. You know, if you can fill a theater in a regional city in China and have the entire audience crying, you're doing something very good and very powerful. And I respect that.
Yeah, so totally.
I've got positive things to say. So I worked there.
Good.
And then, you know, after a few years, it kind of finally kind of came over me like, oh my God, what have you done? You're working, your name is Disney, and you're working in the company. Is this what you're going to do? Like, are you going to be a professional Disney? And something in me was like, I just don't really feel like I want to do my own thing, you know? And so I left and I did a bunch of other things.
That's great.
And I've been very lucky because I've got to do some movies. None of them have been particularly well-known or, you know, none of them have been like giant hits or something like that, but I'm proud of all of them. I've done business things. I've done not-for-profit things. So I've had a varied career and I'm really grateful for that.
Well, one of the things you've done is this most recent one, the Ark. And I would, by the way, it will have appeared. The cover will have appeared, or at least the cover that is available will have appeared at the beginning, and it will appear right now at the end in the edit. And it's wonderful. And people should when it comes, when it's published, people should read it. And it's fabulous. So
thank you. Thank you. Can I add that you can pre-order it on Amazon and barnesandnobles.com and at the website of Gungnir Books, our publisher. And I want to shout out to Matt Medney and his staff at Gungnir Books because they've been fantastic. And my co-writer, JC Lasik, illustrator, Vincent Duborg.
Just wonderful.
Pump my own jam there.
Fabulous. Absolutely. And Tim Disney, thank you so much for being willing to have this meandering, far-reaching, and really fun for me, and I hope for everybody else, and I hope for you, conversation.
Totally fun. Thank you so much. I hope we cross paths again.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.